Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us this entire hour, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Welcome to you, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
Dave Anderson was, if you heard our promo, meaning to join us. He was called away, can't join us this hour. Nothing to worry about, though, and we'll continue with Jim. We're in good hands, flying solo with Jim as our analyst this hour. We'll be covering a lot of turf. We'll talk about the latest border security deal in just a moment. The Green New Deal, we've been hearing a lot about that in the past week. Also, I want to ask Jim about his thoughts on politics surrounding guns. Tomorrow, the one-year anniversary of that horrible Parkland school massacre in Florida. If you'd like to join our conversation about any of the topics today or raise a political topic that's on your mind, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, Jim, and you and I have both been watching the latest on this border deal, bipartisan measure on border security being taken up by the House, I guess it could be taken up, providing funding that the president has demanded for a wall, the Senate evidently to follow, some conservatives denouncing the proposal as a sellout. But let's listen to the president himself speaking at a press conference yesterday, expressing dissatisfaction with the new proposal for border security funding put forward by that congressional committee.
I have to study it. I'm not happy about it. It's not doing the trick, but I'm adding things to it. And when you add whatever I have to add, it's all going to happen where we're going to build a beautiful, big, strong wall that's not going to let criminals and traffickers and drug dealers and drugs into our country. It's very simple. It's very simple. We're building a wall.
Okay. In a press conference yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters he believes that Trump and the Republicans got a good deal on funding for border security. He stated that he hopes the president signs the deal to avoid another government shutdown.
I think he's got a pretty good deal here. You know, the speaker said there wouldn't be a dollar for a wall. Well, I guess we're going to have an argument now about what's a wall, but barriers. And that they wanted a cap on detention apprehension. So, I think he's done just fine. I hope he'll conclude that because he's got to sign the bill.
Okay, Jim, so many more voices out there. Those were the two of them, Mitch McConnell and the president's voice there. What are your thoughts after observing what's been happening the last few days after this congressional committee came up with a bipartisan solution here?
Well, I think the president will ultimately sign this measure, although obviously it'll work through the House and the Senate. There might be some tweaking of it. I suspect that, you know, this is the kind of deal that nobody is entirely satisfied with. I mean, certainly there's going to be Democratic opposition within the House to give any of this funding for a wall. But on the other hand, and probably in the Senate, some of the senatorial presidential candidates are unlikely to go along with this, to certainly stand up to Trump, if you will, in terms of over this wall. But I think the president will ultimately sign it. I don't think he can afford, and frankly, the country probably cannot afford, another government shutdown. The previous government shutdown, had an important hit on the growth of the economy, and of course that's one of President Trump's sort of major calling cards here in terms of his reelection effort is the keeping the economy running. So I think he will sign it. I do think that he will probably go ahead and try to get funding, as has been speculated, from other accounts here, the Department of Defense. We're likely to have a kind of a court case over that because, declaring a national emergency, the president can do that. I mean, there's wide latitude to do that. I think there'll be a challenge to that. But the Congress would have to override that special emergency or that national emergency, by a joint resolution, which would require a presidential signature. And so the president is obviously unlikely to sign that. Mm-hmm. So we'll go to the courts. This will kind of drag on for some time. So the Democrats have the kind of the issue of standing up to the president over this and continuing this kind of debate over whether this kind of wall is really needed. And the Republicans, of course, have the wall issue, and President Trump can continue to say that, you know, he's standing firm on his pledge and that, you know, he's got this obstructionist Congress and so on. So there, you know, it's probably not the best outcome for the country, but politically it's probably satisfying both to Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I wanted to have you react, and perhaps you heard it this morning on Morning Edition, to something that Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, a Democrat, said. He was talking with Noelle King of NPR, she asked about the President Trump's claim. She asked Leahy about President Trump's claim that he could find funding for a border wall in other places.
It's very limited where he could get money. There's always some transfer ability, but where are you going to transfer it from? Are you going to take it out of things that they need? And no, he doesn't have anywhere near the flexibility he thinks he does.
And a national emergency. If he doesn't veto it, if he signs it, but then he declares a national emergency.
Then where is he going to take the money from? Coast Guard, disaster assistance, TSA? You know, the money still has to come from somewhere.
Okay, so you agree with Patrick Leahy's assessment there, Jim?
Yeah, I really do. I don't know. You know, usually under the legislation, there's what's called a 5% reprogramming that can be done. That's usually written into much legislation that the executive branch has the authorization to do, to transfer about a 5% amount of the funding here. The problem is, of course, that one of the other big items that the president has kind of used as a kind of a benchmark of his presidency is to increase the military here and, you know, get to this $700 billion and now $716 billion defense budget. And all of that is going to sort of the modernization of the military as well as to personnel. And whether he would want to risk that reduction in those areas is really a problem. And I think that's what Senator Leahy is referring to.
Mm-hmm. If you have a view on this or a question for Jim McCormick, our analyst, a professor of political science at Iowa State University, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of run up to today. We had that interesting event in El Paso earlier in the week, President Trump holding a rally in El Paso, and also the big claim, if you saw any visuals of that auditorium where he was, I think it held 6,000 to 8,000 people. Was the claim there was not, you know, make America great again or build the wall? It was finish the wall, Jim. Now, some construction may begin this month, according to reports on the wall. But as of January, no new barriers had been built under this administration. I think the New York Times, you know, talked about the president's El Paso rally as very much like a campaign rally and very much full of a need for fact checking. Let's listen to part of that rally. On Monday, El Paso, Texas, president for his 2020 bid for re-election, sticking to his typical script to energize his base, flaunting the arrest records of ICE officers as a reason for a border wall.
Law enforcement, we love them. They keep us safe. In the last 2 years alone, ICE officers have made 200, listen to these numbers, 266,000 arrests of criminal aliens, including those charged or convicted of approximately 100,000 assaults, 40,000 larcenies, 30,000 sex crimes, 25,000 burglaries, 12,000 vehicle thefts, 11,000 robberies, 4,000 kidnappings, and 4,000 murders, killings, murders.
Okay. This is a claim the president made also in his State of the Union address, the fact check there, that it needs quite a bit of context to get to the point where the president was with it. Should be noted that these criminal convictions covered a range of offenses, including many that were nonviolent. Most common charges, traffic violations, possession or selling of drugs, and immigration offenses like illegal entry. So this rally, Jim, what did you take away from this rally, this tactic by the president to go right down to the border? And we'll hear from Beto O'Rourke, too, right, who had a competing rally. But first of all, to Trump's performance here.
Well, I do think, as you suggested, this was really a campaign event. And, you know, finishing the wall, I suppose the only thing that you could remotely that you could suggest that would be contain some accuracy was that if you thought of what action had been done, say, in California and then as part of the larger wall. But certainly in terms, as you pointed out, that there's been really, really no construction. And even this funding that the Congress, at least, or the congressional bipartisan congressional committee talked about, it would be for about, I think, 55 miles of some sort of a barrier here. So this clearly was, a campaign rally. And I think some of the statistics, we don't know, you know, in terms of where those were located and how much they had to do with, you know, with really the border kind of issue here. Where were some of these offenses? And as you said, there were really a wide range of offenses that are included in some of those numbers here. Mm-hmm. Statistics can be used.
And yes, it can.
Well, can be used in a variety of ways here.
Why? The one repeated also from his State of the Union address was that El Paso is safer because
right, of
the border, when in fact the crime rate, and I think it was the Republican mayor of El Paso.
The mayor called him out on that. That's absolutely right. Saying that we have, that the city was. And actually, before the wall was constructed at all, the crime rate was reducing.
Okay, well, let's go to Beto O'Rourke. This is his native city, El Paso. He held his own rally less than a mile away from the one being led by the president on Monday. And here's part of his bilingual speech. In it, Beto O'Rourke, defeated, of course, by Ted Cruz in the midterms, but nevertheless a golden boy for the Democrats, so to speak. Here he is describing his native El Paso as one of the safest cities in the nation.
Not because of walls, but in spite of walls. Secure, because we treat one another with dignity and respect. That is the way that we make our communities and our country safe. Aquí podemos mostrar que si queremos asegurar nuestras comunidades, necesitamos tratar cada persona con dignidad, con respeto, como merecen como humanos.
Beto O'Rourke there on Monday in his competing rally, just a mile away from the president. Jim McCormick, I mean, is this sort of a vision, a preview of what the 2020 election might be, theme-wise?
I think that's one of the themes, but when we talk about some of the other candidates have really, touched sort of other kind of issues and items that they really want to emphasize. But I think what Beto O'Rourke really touches is this kind of generational kind of change here. Mm. And also the bilingualism here that he demonstrated by the clip that you just played will be very, very important given the Hispanic voting bloc and base is really up for grabs among several Democratic candidates. I think his skill in that area and his, kind of experience in a border town like El Paso, after all, he was the U.S. representative from that area, I think will do him well. The question is, as with all of these candidates, can they really break out of the fold of having so many candidates? I mean, we saw that in 2016 with the Republicans, and now we're, by my count, at least there's been 11 announced Democratic candidates, and right, and some of the others that we might expect, like a Biden, for example, here, or O'Rourke, or Sherrod Brown have have not really announced yet, but some of them have, you know, made trips to Iowa here, which is which is not an unobtrusive measure of what their intentions are.
It's really, you have to do your daily check of who is in which category. The people who are expected to announce but haven't yet, people who have formed exploratory committees, then the people who have officially declared. We'll talk about a couple of the two that officially declared this past weekend, Senator Klobuchar and also Senator Elizabeth Warren. I think we'll hold that for the second half hour,
okay,
if you don't mind, Jim. I want to finish up talking about this wall saga. So what are your takeaways with the behavior, the sort of different position of the GOP leadership? We heard Mitch McConnell there encouraging the president to take this deal. The GOP leadership not in lockstep with the president anymore?
No, I don't think so. I think what, you know, first of all, they want to keep the government open. And if you look, they also read the public opinion polls. The public opinion polls have shown that, you know, any kind of government shutdown is basically a losing issue, and that, you know, they're sort of forced to come to the defense of Trump, which they don't really believe in, or they are forced to take a vote, you know, that'll be on the record. That would somehow support Trump, but also could come back to bite them in any kind of electoral cycle here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you really are seeing is they're trying to prod the president to, you know, make this a kind of accommodation here, and to really sort of adopt the phrase, you know, that politics is the art of the possible here. It's the Lyndon Johnson phraseology that I like to rely upon. Let's come together. Let's come and reason together here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this bipartisan committee really illustrated that there was the possibility of people coming together and reasoning together. You know, we haven't even talked about, but, you know, one of the things that was thrown on the table, I guess, over the weekend was putting a cap on the number of detention beds and so on.
Right.
But that quickly seemed to evaporate when there obviously was, I would guess, some not only Republican pushback, but Republicans saying on the committee that they were willing to accept this lower number in terms of, you know, any kind of barrier funding, I guess, is the accurate descriptor.
Mm-hmm. So a hopeful sign, perhaps, when we talk so much about a dysfunctional Congress, you see in this committee, the deal they hammered out.
Yeah,
each side giving a bit of hope, you think.
It really is. I mean, you know, Richard Shelby, who you might expect to be a very, very strong Trump supporter here, obviously was willing to step up and take a deal and to say, you know, the president ought to go ahead and basically sign this deal.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, back to the president's position here, he has obviously seen this as a key to his reelection in 2020. Can the president claim victory should he sign this? Will his base buy it? Sean Hannity didn't.
No, I mean, Sean Hannity called it, I think I read it, called
garbage
it a garbage
deal.
Compromise
yeah.
here.
Okay,
and
garbage
so,
something.
Yeah, and so in any event, no, the base is going to be unhappy, but What I think is going to happen is the president is going to say that he's going to go, as he said, even in his speech in El Paso, and then later when they asked him to comment for the media on the bill, saying he was not happy, but he also said the wall is going to be built. I think the idea of keeping this issue going is what we're going to see for the 2020 election, and the kind of determination that the president is going to stand firm on trying to get this done. Whether he can actually reprogram money from, say, the defense budget or some other pot of money here, but rather he still has the issue. So I don't think he can claim victory, but he can point the finger and point the blame not on his determination, but on someone else.
Political scientist Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Before we go to break in about 4 minutes, Jim, I want to ask you about a new part of our vocabulary, at least in mainstream, you know, kitchen talk. Perhaps it has reached that, the Green New Deal. Last week, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, very popular among Democrats, a representative in New York, also very progressive. Also, Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat of Massachusetts, unveiled this Green New Deal framework. Now, the New Deal, hearkening back, this goes back to predates most of us, Jim, to the New Deal.
Even me.
The New Deal of the Roosevelt era, which pulled us out of the Depression. Now, this legislation is a non-binding resolution that is meant to outline a plan to, I guess, what, massively curtail carbon emissions, also undertaking some really big economic changes to boost jobs and workers' rights. I don't know if I encapsulated it quite right there, Jim, but what are your thoughts about the launch of this Green New Deal? Are the Democrats unified behind this legislation?
Well, many of the presidential candidates that have announced certainly have endorsed it in one way or the other. Some of them have been sort of pulled back. Klobuchar, for example, Senator Klobuchar, said that, you know, she would support the kind of the resolution and then come to look at what the bill actually said.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherrod Brown said, well, you know, he's favorable to the general idea, but, you know, he might have some question mark about, you know, the actual details of it. I think what this is, if you reflect back for a moment, in the President's State of the Union address, one of the things, even though he had a great litany of a lot of different issues, one of the issues that he left out was climate change. Mm. Any real serious discussion of climate change. So maybe it's not such a surprise that this would be announced, this new Green Deal, although it had been speculated earlier in the aftermath of the president's speech. But it really is, shall we say, ambitious in a 10-year period to upgrade all existing buildings for energy efficiency, to eliminate pollution and greenhouse gases from farming, overhaul the transportation system to reduce emissions, provide guaranteed jobs, family-sustaining wage jobs, mm-hmm. and, you know, universal health care, and so on. And to do this in a 10-year window is really quite ambitious. And I don't think, at least the accounts that I've read, that they put a price tag on this.
Right.
But aside from getting something, getting all of these things enacted, either in block or even separately, is going to be a horrendous legislative challenge. And then secondly, of course, and maybe firstly, actually, coming up with the funding to pay for this. But in terms of addressing an issue that I think the public has some concern about,
right,
and that has not been addressed, and that is the issue of, you know, of climate change. And the administration, you know, this is one of their sort of the blank spots here in terms of doing anything about it. First of all, they have dismissed it as a real issue, and then not taking any substantive action. So it gives a real calling card, although obviously all of this is in sort of the fine details of working it out.
Okay, we'll be back with Jim McCormick, our political scientist, professor of political science at Iowa State University, on this Politics Wednesday to talk about the new official entries into the Democratic field, wishing to take on the president in the 2020 general election. Also, we'll talk about gun politics. It is tomorrow the anniversary of the Parkland massacre. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, with us this hour. And still to come, we want to talk about the Parkland massacre anniversary and whether or the degree to which that's changed any of our gun-related politics. That in just a few moments, if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Always far too many political developments to get into 1 hour, so picking out a few of them. Let's talk about this past weekend and this huge Democratic field of 2020 candidates vying for the chance to take on President Trump. Two more candidates officially announcing. Remember, we said there are several categories here. People like Biden, for instance, who have uh-huh. not said they will or they won't. There are, you know, Beto O'Rourke, also in that category. Others who have formed exploratory committees. And this is the category of people They have joined this category, Senators Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, who have officially announced over the weekend they are candidates. Let's focus on the two of them. This is some priceless video, Jim, if you saw it.
Yes.
Senator Klobuchar announcing her presidential bid in true Minnesota fashion from Minneapolis in a snowstorm. Let's hear a bit of it.
In the first 100 days of my administration, I will reinstate the clean power rules and the gas mileage standards and put forth sweeping legislation to invest in green jobs and infrastructure. And on day one, we will rejoin the International Climate Agreement.
When you look at the Democratic candidates in the race, or probably going to be in the race, Jim, where do you put Amy Klobuchar?
Well, in some senses, I think she's in a pretty good position because she is from the Midwest, and of course, that's where the Democrats, at least in the Electoral College, did not succeed here. And she has won her races pretty handily in Minnesota, and the usual handicapping is that she not only attracts urban voters and suburban voters, but she also has attraction for rural voters. So I think in that sense, she comes out, you know, in terms of just being positioned much better than, say, you know, the East and West Coast candidates that have announced for the races. I mean, you know, a candidate from California or a candidate from Massachusetts, those states and those individuals might have not have the same kind of appeal in the middle west part of the country here that an Amy Klobuchar would have. And so I think in that sense, she is a bit advantaged. I suppose the one issue that she would face, again, with all presidential candidates, is how well known she is beyond this middle part of the country here. But, you know, that's possible, I think, to break into. And particularly if you add one further thing, if in fact it's the case, which seems to be the issue here, that Democrats have kind of lost working class support, you know, kind of a traditional base here, you know, she will be able to tap into that. So I would put her in, you know, for pretty high marks in terms of the kind of candidates that have announced already.
I don't know what polls you're watching. I'm seeing the new Morning Consult poll released yesterday. Now, they're going to track every week how Democratic presidential candidates are doing among Democratic primary voters nationwide, also in the early voting states. Uh-huh. Here in Iowa, they're focusing on Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. And so this will be an interesting poll to watch week by week as it changes. Now, as in this first report put out this week, Biden and Sanders lead the pack, two that haven't declared, followed by Kamala Harris among the Democrats with the others there. So that's interesting. Very early days. And, of course, what, Jim, at this point, name recognition counts for quite a bit.
Name recognition. And, you know, Klobuchar was, you know, just announced her candidacy, although it has been speculated for some time. So yeah, she might well get a boost after the announcement, you know, sort of percolates among the public at large. But those other, you know, Biden and Sanders are not surprising at all, given that they've been, you know, involved in presidential politics previously, have wide name recognition, as you said. And, you know, even if you go back and look at the Register poll, the Iowa poll here, you know, that those are the candidates that come out near the top as well. And same with Harris.
Okay, let's talk about the other Democrat who officially announced over the weekend that she is in this race to face Donald Trump in the general election of 2020, Massachusetts Senator Democrat Elizabeth Warren, formally announcing her presidential race from Lawrence, Massachusetts on Monday. It was a rally that lasted more than 40 minutes, with Warren telling personal anecdotes from her personal and political history, also taking a hard line against corruption and elitism in Washington.
And when it comes to climate change, our very existence is at stake. But Washington refuses to lift a finger without permission from the fossil fuel companies. That's dangerous and it's wrong. And it isn't just climate change. Look at any other major issue in America. Gun violence, student loan debt, the crushing cost of health care, mistreatment of our veterans, a broken criminal justice system, an immigration system that lacks common sense, and under this administration, lacks a conscience.
Elizabeth Warren on Monday. So, Jim, that's in a different category. Also with Sanders, is the same. This is the whole system is rotten and has to be overhauled.
Yes, it's inequality, it seems to me. I was, just making some notes about, talking about the inequality on all of those kind of issues and the lack of equitable treatment. I think that really is her theme in terms of her campaign. So she can talk about all of these issues under that sort of rubric of as you suggested, the system is not very equal, and particularly, I didn't hear it in that clip. She talks about how working people have not been treated fairly by this system, but that goes along again with this larger issue of inequality within the system here.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about other issues, we had several mentioned here in the last few minutes, finishing up with our Democratic 2020 candidates and potential candidates. Are you seeing issues that the Democrats are definitely coalescing around? I'm thinking maybe Medicare for all and maybe this Green New Deal.
Yeah, I think the issues are climate change and inequality. And I suppose just as Senator Warren mentioned, sort of elitism too. That's always a good theme for candidates to take on, that Washington has forgot about people here. But I think there's also another theme that cuts across some of these candidates that have been announced, and that is what I would put under the rubric of identity politics, because race has been is an issue, and gender is an issue too, that they're going to talk about considerably here. I mean, you have some African American candidates here. You have some, I think half of the announced candidates are now women for the presidency, and mm-hmm. and at least Kirsten Gillibrand has said that she is going to make feminist politics sort of the overarching theme of her campaign as well.
Jim McCormick with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University on this Politics Wednesday. We have just over 10 minutes left, and I wanted to get your analysis, Jim, and perhaps take a caller here as we mark tomorrow the tragic anniversary of that Parkland shooting. We had massive student protests across the country, sort of reshaping a U.S. debate on firearms after a former student of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, killed 17 people with a semi-automatic rifle. It was just 5.5 minutes of this shooting spree 1 year ago, February 14th, 2018. We saw protests all across the country. Yes, also here in Iowa among young people, students. We heard several Iowa student protesters on this program last year during 2018. I'm just putting it out there, Jim. The protests seem to have reshaped the U.S. debate on firearms. How and how much, in your opinion?
Well, they have a little bit, but there's this kind of serendipitous response to these terrible acts of violence here. There is interest, and then it fades. It has a decaying effect pretty rapidly. Now, maybe with the anniversary, and I note that there's now being a bill introduced in Congress that would take up at least these high capacity machine guns and so on. Whether that will really even get to a vote or not, some members are going to be very, very reluctant given what the constituencies that they come from, whether even to vote on that. Obviously, some would like to get a vote on it, get it on the record that they're not standing up to, in this case, the NRA, the National Rifle Association here. But I'm not sure that I would go along that it really has changed the entire debate yet. Mm-hmm. It really kind of ebbs and flows, and sort of we're back to a great deal of complacency about this issue.
Does the NRA, in your opinion, Jim, have as much sway over many lawmakers, the influence that it did and has had in the past in Washington, now as compared to before Parkland?
It's hard to detect that there's been any kind of lapse in terms of the kind of influence that the NRA has. I mean, after all, they provide funding. They have even gone on to have national campaigns on television. I noticed that at least on some of the cable channels, they have advertisements that continue on. And so those are problems that any kind of change really faces. I think the ultimate test would be if they could get a vote on this and get some of these members on record.
Mm-hmm.
I think that will bring the issue back to kind of a high profile. I've not seen, except maybe tangentially, any of these presidential candidates really talk about that, except maybe in a vague mention of it. Certainly, it has not gotten up high on the agenda, if you will. In terms of their campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Jim, pivoting back to our 2020 field of candidates, it was interesting yesterday that the former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, under President Obama, announced that he'll decide on a 2020 presidential run in about 3 weeks. Let's listen to a little bit of him. He spoke yesterday, with reporters outside the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Let's listen to a clip of that.
You know, whether you have the vision, the experience, the ability to inspire others to deal with the issues of the day. So I'm going to sit down, with my family, very soon.
Okay, so you see potential there, Eric Holder?
Certainly he's interested in it, but, he's not somebody who's run for elective office before. And that may be, we now have some candidates who have had that kind of electoral experience. And I don't think there's much of a substitute for that, particularly as you break into the presidential arena. Although immediately as I say that, you're going to point out to me that Donald Trump did
the obvious. Yes.
Yeah. But I think that particularly with this wide open field and that, he has probably limited name recognition. He obviously was an attorney general in the Obama administration, but I think that will be a challenge for him. I noticed in some of the statements that he's made, he's not really kind of captured a unifying theme, except that he says that he wants to bring the country together, and I'm not sure that he'll have to set out the kind of values and beliefs that he's going to use as a focal point of his campaign, if he's really to be a serious contender, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Jim, in the last few minutes here, I'd like to draw upon your international political expertise here. Let's go afield to perhaps Venezuela. That was in the top of the hour news. It's been 3 weeks since the U.S.-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido invoked a constitutional provision to declare himself Venezuela's interim president. He argues that Nicolas Maduro's re-election last year was a sham.
Right.
Now, most Western countries, the U.S., but also Europe, other countries, many other countries, recognizing Guaido as Venezuela's president. Where do you see the thing standing right now? And what are you watching?
I think it's significant that the Lima group is going to get together, and that was part of the announcement here. To try to put additional pressure on it. What is interesting to me is that a number of South American countries have also, endorsed Guaido here. One of the significant countries that has not, of course, is Mexico, which is obviously a crucial country in the region here, and whether they can be brought around to put pressure on it. But, if the humanitarian crisis grows and if there is a kind of exposure of the humanitarian crisis that is already occurring in Venezuela, mm-hmm. I think there will be. I even think Mexico could move in that direction, and that would not be insignificant. It seems to me in terms of turning the tide here. No American soldiers, though. I mean, I think this idea of if there's this kind of talk about moving American military into Colombia or wherever a neighboring country. The intervention by the United States would be the worst possible option in terms of turning some of these countries against the United States and giving more support to Maduro here.
With the view of this administration in South America, has the U.S. role thus far in Venezuela for the opposition been helpful, do you think?
I think what is significant about the Trump administration is, you know, they have not put very much emphasis upon human rights at all in their foreign policy, and good governance and democratic governance here. And here you have, you know, the one example of it. And I think that, you know, that might well be the reason that some of these countries have rallied to support. The problem is that and I ought to mention that Russia and China, and surprisingly Turkey, but I think that's explainable in terms of the kind of leadership in Turkey at the present time, have become major supporters of Maduro. And so, you know, that's continued going to be a stumbling block for the U.S. But I think the emphasis on human rights, the emphasis on democracy, is a real change for the Trump administration in terms of its foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. A quick word before we say goodbye, looking over as we follow the Brexit story, the relationship of Britain to the rest of Europe, counting down here. We've got a deadline coming up.
March 29th is the deadline.
Okay,
yes.
And explain to us what we're coming up to there and the position Britain finds itself in.
Well, you know, that's the deadline for when Britain would have to exit the European Union here. And they have not been able to get the Parliament to approve an agreement on terms of the terms of the agreement for the withdrawal with the EU. They want to sort of stay and have access in terms of some free from the market, the single market, partly to keep the Irish border open, but the Parliament has not been going along with that, and now the EU has said they will not renegotiate. So they're really at a standstill, it seems to me. I think the best possible outcome, and maybe it's my hope for the outcome, is that there would be a second referendum, because public opinion seems to have turned a bit in the UK to maybe remaining within the EU. It's so disruptive, and maybe the damage has already been done in terms of some companies leaving Britain. But my hope is that maybe that will be the direction that they'll pursue. I don't. The EU has been staunch in not renegotiating the terms of departure.
Here's a little tax season tidbit in political news. Jim, before we say goodbye, you sure saw this, I'm sure. Our U.S. Senator Joni Ernst last week repaid almost $1,900 for a tax break that she had claimed on her Washington, D.C. condo since 2016, simultaneously claiming it on a similar tax break here in Iowa. Her office said her claim of the homestead tax credit in Washington was an error that she's rectified with a check. Ernst wrote the check to the Washington, D.C. Office of Tax and Revenue Friday. This, importantly, 2 days after the Des Moines Register inquired about the matter. So the Des Moines Register asked about it, and she looked at that and paid it back with a check. Not immediately clear, according to the Register's Jason Clayworth, what, if any, penalty Ernst faces, according to his reporting, according to the IRS. Any political repercussions for Senator Ernst here on this, do you think, Jim?
She has a election coming up in 2020, and I'm sure we will see that, and probably a campaign ad by the opposition that you know, that there was this failure to do this. Whether there will be a penalty or not, I think is you know, the IRS, usually if you voluntarily make adjustments, they usually forego the penalty here. If you right. If you were the one to fess up, if you will.
Yes, but after being reported on by a newspaper.
That's true. It was not, I guess it was not her own fessing up,
she was
out.
Prompted into fessing up, I guess you could.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it will be, you know, whether it be, I don't think it'd be a major kind of issue, but, you know, that homestead requirement is pretty standard that people should be aware of. You have to say where your permanent residence is, and then you can get homestead credit here. Usually they require you to show, to gain that homestead credit, something like your driver's license to say, this is where I really live. So.
Okay. Hey, Jim, we're at the end of the hour. Thank you very much for being with us this hour with your insights. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Until
you,
next
Ben.
Time, Jim. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ben.
You're welcome. Well, modern medicine helps us live longer, but what about the quality of those extra years? Tomorrow on this program, my guest is award-winning author Katie Butler. She has a new book out called The Art of Dying Well. It's a manual for living, aging, and dying with meaning and even joy. You can tell us tomorrow during the show about a meaningful death perhaps you have witnessed tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.